Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to New Books and Literature, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben, and today my guest is Paul Kingsnorth. Paul is the author of several books of poetry, essays and commentary, including Real England and Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist, as well as three novels, The Wake, which was listed for the Man Booker Prize in 2014, Beast, and Alexandria. We're talking today about Alexandria, just published in the US by Grey Wolf Press and forthcoming in the UK from Faber. Paul, congratulations on the book and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Crawford, and thanks for having me along.
It's really great that we can have you today. Before we begin talking about the novel, would you be able to share a passage of it that we could listen to?
I will do that. I'll give you a bit of context before I do. We'll talk about the book a bit more in a minute, but this is a book which is set some considerable time in the future. The register in which people speak, obviously, is rather different to the register we speak now. But also the book is, it contains its own mythology, if you like, as all of my novels do, actually. But what I'm going to read here is a couple of sections of a sort of canto that runs through the book, which is the mythology of the group who the book is based around. So it's a kind of creation myth, if you like, for the state of humankind as it has ended up in about 1,000 years from now. Back then, all land was holt, all holt was whites, man and deer, fox and brock, lion and wolf, cat and boar, as one in peace. But one was broke, a true world's making, one black beast low and creeping, deep in holt his great world tree. At its roots, curling, winding, still, silent, breathing low, old serpent. Now old serpent, waking slow, winding up around roots, through clay, into air, calling now, calling quiet, man, man, come to me, for I bring gifts. Back then man comes, mind running, fingers curling, man walking, man working, man seeing old serpent, man said, what is this that has no form? What is this unclean and dark, twining low round oldest tree? This is no holy thing. And serpent says, there is no holy thing, man, but you. And man says, this is not way. And what are you? You are no thing of this ground. You have no arms, you have no legs, you have no hair, and from your tongues come broken words. And serpent said, I am no thing of this ground. I am thing from under it. I am thing from before world's making. I am thing from outside way. I bring truth from underground. Come, man, come. Climb world tree and from its crown. Then you will see. Then man climbing great world tree and serpent binding limb to branch with his long black body. Man hangs on tree 9 days and nights. Calling, crying, crying, calling. All whites of land came round him saying, something is coming. Back then on 10th day, come with light then, great black bird, beak of blood and eyes of fire. No bird of earth, no bird of Erka. It circles tree, calls in speech that no white knew. Then serpent unbinding man, man falls down back to clay. Back then, all whites gathered round man. Fox nuzzled him, Brock found him food, lying laying with him, giving him heat. Then man, opening his eyes, then man lived. Then man stood on legs tall with new fire and new eyes. Now man looking through new eyes at Holt, and looking now at whites before him, and man saying, I have seen new story. I have seen that way is not true. I have seen world must be broken. For inside is white fire of truth. Only in broken things is truth found. And man said, now I shall seek fire. Now I shall walk in white light of my making. Land and sea, clay and waters, birds and white shall bend to me. Fire of my seeking will cover all things and make world as it should be. Then tears come into all whites in Holt for what had come and would. Now all crying, calling, man, do not leave us, man, do not go. And man saying, whites, I am gone far these 9 days and nights. For me, there is no return.
That's wonderful, Paul. Thank you so much. It's a great sequence of extracts, isn't it? Because it opens so much up about the novel, but also about your broader writing career to date, seeing new stories and seeing things new. How did you come to see things new as a writer?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it? I often say that, I think this might be true of a lot of writers, I end up relentlessly telling the same story over and over again in different forms for about 25 years. I've done 10 books now, and actually they're all variants on the story. And actually that's, as you say, quite a good summary of the story that I write about, which is the breaking of the link between humans and the rest of the natural world, the rest of the wild world, which is also a breaking of the link, I think, between the human world and the divine, if you like, as manifested in the wild world, as manifested in our desire to kind of leave the rest of nature and strike out on our own. And I don't know that that's a new story. In fact, it's a very old story that I've somehow sort of intuited since I was a child and have sort of struggled all my life as a writer to try and put into words in a lot of different ways. I first started off as an activist writer. I was an environmental campaigner. For a long time, I got into that at university, having kind of fallen in love with the natural world as a child. I wanted to try and do something about it when I became a student, got politicized, as a lot of students do, became a road protester and an activist and an anti-globalization activist and all sorts for many years. And I wrote about that. I wrote books from that perspective. And then I around 10 years ago, things changed a bit for me. And I realized that a lot of this activism wasn't working, broadly speaking, that the chances of changing, yeah, there's plenty of things you can do with activism on a local or even a national scale, but in terms of the big picture, things are not turning around realistically. The way that the industrial machine is going is not going to be turned around by anything, I think, probably that we can do voluntarily at this point. And that led me to start the Dark Mountain Project, and that's an international collective of writers and artists who are looking for new stories or at least new ways of telling old stories. And the idea behind that was that we are living in quite an apocalyptic time now, literally in the sense that apocalypse means unveiling. You know, we're unveiling things about our culture that we are uncomfortable with seeing. And we're living in an age of climate change and mass extinction and forest destruction and catastrophic unsustainability, as it were, on all levels. But writers, in many cases, certainly when we started the project, are not really writing as if this was true. We're writing as if it were sort of a blip on our road towards permanent progress rather than something which changes everything. And I actually think it does. The state of the world at the moment changes everything, including the way we ought to be writing about it. So that's sort of what I've tried to do, I suppose, in some ways through my novels, is to meet the challenge that we set when we started the Dark Mountain Project, which is to ask what stories would we be telling now as writers and human beings if we took this situation seriously? You know, if we actually wrote as if we were living in this radically apocalyptic age, which I think we are, how would we write and how would we live? And as I say, yeah, I think the novels I've been writing are one attempt to answer that question.
If I could just push back a little bit on that, Paul, obviously your writing includes books like Real England, which, you know, caused a huge amount of discussion when it came out back about what must be about 15 years ago now, just over. And as you think about themes of nationhood and culture and economics in that book, do you see those themes running through your other writing as well?
That's a non-fiction book, came out in 2008, and that was very much about how the global economic machine, the process of global capitalism, really, global consumerism was erasing local cultures in England, which is the country I come from. And it was a follow-up in some ways to the book I'd written a few years before, which was called One No Many Yeses, and that was a global travelogue, and that was a look at how global capitalism was sort of killing off cultures and communities around the world, and how people were resisting it, mainly. That was really a book about resistance to that situation, from, you know, the Zapatistas to the people in the townships in South Africa to the protests in the streets of Europe. And it was really, it is, the themes do run through all of my work, yes, because it's, as I say, it's about the relationship between, my work is about the relationship between humans and the wild world that we've walked away from, but also what it means to be part of human culture, maybe part of a nation as well. What do these things mean? I mean, the question that Real England asked was, what is England if its local cultures are erased? You know, that's a wider question. What is any country if its local cultures are erased? I've always been fundamentally a localist politically, and I think that any culture is only as good as its local communities and its local places and the way that it nurtures them. Patrick Kavanagh, the Irish poet, said, you know, all culture begins with a particular. All culture is parochial, actually, literally, in the sense that, you know, if you don't have a healthy parish, a very, very local small place, then you haven't got a nation. So, yeah, and that is certainly a question that runs through the novels in a slightly different form as well. You know, what does it mean to be a people in a place, especially if you're undermining the foundations of the place and the community? So, yeah, that's a sort of wider theme as well.
Mm. Well, when you began writing the novels back with The Wake and then following into The Beast and then into Alexandria that we're talking about today, did you conceive of this project as a trilogy in its formation?
No, I didn't actually. I started writing The Wake, which, as you say, is a book set during the Norman Conquest. And I wrote that, I mean, I started writing that about 10 years ago, actually, just after I finished Real England. I came across a book by a historian called Peter Rex, which was called The English Resistance. And I thought, that's an interesting title. I wonder what that's about. And it was about the guerrilla war that was fought by the English after the Norman Conquest, which I hadn't ever heard about. You don't learn it in school. You learn about the conquest and then you kind of move on to the Middle Ages. And I hadn't realized that there was, you know, the equivalent of the French resistance against German occupation going on in the woods and in the villages of England for 10 years. And I thought, well, that's a good story. I wonder what that would be like told from the perspective of someone who was engaged in it. And so that's the story I told. Books are strange things. They start to behave in ways that you don't expect. So what was almost a political piece of sort of political historical writing could have, if I was lucky, it didn't turn into an English Braveheart, actually, but it didn't. I deliberately avoided that fate by making my central character hideous. But, you know, what that turned out to be actually was also a novel full of mythology and tales about the relationship between people and the wild country that they lived in. So that turned out to be a much wider mythological book about, resistance to invasion, effectively. It wasn't intended to be part of a trilogy at all. I wrote it in its own language. It was quite hard to write, though. It was fun. I had no intention of ever doing anything like that again when I finished. But it wasn't long after I finished that I thought, wouldn't it be interesting to trace this story across time? Because, as I say, The Wake is about relationship between people and place. The central character in The Wake has such a kind of intense, self-loving relationship with what he imagines his culture is that it ends up destroying him. He's so fixated on a particular notion of what England is, and he's also fixated on a notion of being a hero, that he ends up with neither of those things, and he ends up, you know, destroying a lot of things that he claims to value. So it's an exploration of what it means and what the opportunities and dangers are in that kind of connection. So I thought, okay, well, let's trace this man's line over 2,000 years and see what happens. So I'm going to do three books. I'm going to do The Wake, and then I'm going to do another book set today, 1,000 years later, and then a final book set in 1,000 years' time. And they're very different books in many ways. You can read them all separately, but the themes are the same. They trace the same family line over time. They mostly trace the same place and its relationship with the people as well. And the thing I haven't mentioned, perhaps, is that in all of these books, the place is very much alive. There's a sentient landscape, if you like, throughout this whole book. Because another one of my great themes is that the natural world is very much more alive than we think it is. It's not just a landscape or a backdrop that human characters can have adventures in. It's part of the story, and it changes things, and it reacts to us, and it gives and takes from us as well. So that was another thing that I wanted to explore. So no, it wasn't a plan, is the answer to your question, but it ended up being sort of 10 years of my life.
And it's an amazing read when they are read back to back, because so many of the themes and images and so on drift between the books in such evocative ways. Buckmaster, the central character family, I suppose, that you trace, but also notions of speaking animals, especially birds, the Wayland character theme idea that runs through. Don't want to give too much away about Alexandria, but how do you construct that kind of almost cosmic superstructure for these individual novels?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it did develop quite organically. I think if I'd sat down to plan it, it wouldn't have been nearly as convincing or interesting. A lot of it kind of emerged. What I tried to do, having written The Wake, when I started to write Beast, I thought, okay, well, this is also a relationship between a man and a place, but very, very different to The Wake. I mean, Beast literally just has one character in it all the way through. You're never quite sure whether anything that's happening to him is real, whatever that means. It's very much a relationship between a man and his mind, as much as a man and anything else. So, but as you say, the imagery, the landscape imagery, the creatures who appear, they're very, very deliberately taken from The Wake and woven into the story. And by the time you get to Alexandria, which is much more similar to The Wake than it is to Beast. Beast is the kind of black sheep of the trilogy, if you like. It's a very different kind of book in all sorts of ways. But I'm able to wind the story, especially the story of the kind of mythical world of The Wake, I'm able to wind it back into Alexandria and give it a conclusion that maybe isn't expected or certainly wasn't planned. Yeah, so it's something that emerged organically, but I was always quite careful to use certain images. I won't say what they are particularly, but there are certain images, there are certain lines, there are certain phrases that deliberately repeat and call back all the way through the book, all the way through all three books. Actually, there are particular phrases that always appear, particular creatures that always appear, particular images from mythology that always appear. They're kind of following this family line all the way through the centuries, and giving them things, offering them things, making demands of them that kind of change the way that they relate to the world.
And religion matters too, Paul, doesn't it? So in The Wake, as you say, it's very much poised in the balance of the Norman Conquest, and the Buckmaster character is very concerned to preserve what he remembers of the older religion in the face of this almost totalitarian, rapacious invasion of Christianity and its institutions. By the time we come to The Beast, a church is quite central to that. A church building is quite central to it. The character both appreciates it, somehow feels himself outsider perhaps at points, but it's always vacant. And then, of course, religion has an important role in Alexandria too. Do you see yourself as a religious writer or as a writer about religion?
Well, you know, I think I do see myself as a religious writer these days. I think I always, in some ways, it's interesting, you know, because this is a central theme of the trilogy. I mean, it depends what you mean by religious, I suppose. I don't want to use the word spiritual because it sounds a bit too New Age, doesn't it? But it's fundamentally a series of books, at least in part, about the religious experience, the human experience of the divine and the need to connect to it and the fact that actually that is central to every culture. And it's interesting what you say about the empty church, actually, because in The Wake, absolutely central to the book, and interestingly, this wasn't what I intended to write about when I first thought about this book. I didn't think about the religious aspect, but it turned out that the central character is one of the last kind of pagans, one of the last Anglo-Saxon worshippers of the old house, as he calls it, the old gods. And, you know, Christianity has been in England for a long time by the 11th century, but I imagined, and it might be true, that there were still pockets of the old ways clinging on. And Buckmaster sees absolutely the twin kind of invasions of the Christian religion, which he sees as this foreign religion of the book that has nothing to do with the place he's in. And of course, the Normans turning up and seizing the land and seizing the kingdom. So he sees these as these two threats to his relationship, to his sense of nationhood and his relationship to his place. And so it's fundamentally religious. You've got these two religious worldviews, you know, going up against each other in The Wake. But the faith, if you like, the gods are central to wherever you come in. With Beast, you've got a man who is he's a contemporary man. He's one of us, right? So he's run from the cities, he's run from the modern world, from the machine, and he's trying to find something in some of the last wild places in England, he doesn't really know even what he's trying to find or what the hell he's doing. He doesn't have a structure for it. As you say, the church is empty. He doesn't have a religion. He doesn't quite know what he's looking for. He finds something, or it finds him, without wanting to give too much away. And again, it's very much tied up with the living landscape. You know, the stories and the religion come through the living landscapes in these books. So the land will give you what you need if you know how to listen to it. It might not be what you want, and it might not be something you enjoy very much, but it will be what you need. But as you say, the church is empty. There's no form for his quest at all, because that's where we are. And in the future, again, the beast, Alexandria is the most explicitly, at the center of Alexandria is a religious order. You know, the central characters are living in a small remnant religious order 1,000 years from now on the flooded fens of Eastern England. So that's very specifically quite paganistic, but also actually quite Christian religious order, but quite deliberately syncretic. It's constructed of a lot of bits of various faiths that exist in England now, ones that I have experience of, Christianity, various paganisms, a bit of Sikhism in there, a bit of Sufis, all sorts of stuff hanging around in there. And it's an earth religion, and it's you know, set up to specifically resist the kind of the machine thinking that's been trailing all of these characters. So in a way, there's a story, a dualism all the way through these books. There's a kind of a sense of the divine that comes through the place you're in, a sense of God that can relate you to the land that you're in, wherever that is, versus this kind of tyrannical machine culture that is about self-worship and materialism and you know, growth at any cost, effectively. So there's that kind of eternal battle going on. So yeah, it is very much a religious trilogy in that sense. And that's interestingly something that no reviewer picks up on or hasn't done until recently, which has always interested me. Very, very few people actually spot that, certainly in the mainstream anyway. More people in the margins tend to spot it more, but it's interesting. It was kind of hiding in plain sight there.
Life is good in the margins.
It was more interesting, exactly.
Yeah. Well, you made the point there, Paul, about the similarity between the Wake and Alexandria and the way in which Beast is sort of a little bit different from both. Are you making a point there in terms of form and content about the connectedness or disconnectedness of past, present and future?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, it's not, again, it's a point that's organic rather than planned from the beginning. But I mean, I wanted to write a book in which there was just one person and a place. I wanted to see if I could do that. I had very particular ideas. I mean, that's structured around a very particular spiritual quest, a very particular form of actually a particular Buddhist form that I was involved in at the time, quite deliberately, specifically structured around that. So I wanted to write a very lonely book, actually, with just one person in a place. But as you say, there's also a very deliberate painting of a time that's quite broken. I mean, everybody's living in a broken time, right? These are all apocalyptic novels. They're all about people dealing with collapses of one kind or another, whether they're personal or national or ecological or all of those things, cultural, whatever it is. All the people at the center of these books feel like they are experiencing a collapse in their familiar worlds. And forces are rushing into them that they don't know how to control. But yes, Beast is very, it's a very lonely book, actually. It's a very lonely kind of broken book. And as I say, this man at the center of this book doesn't really have any help for the quest he's on. There's no structure for it. And that feels like very much where you are in a modern country like Britain today. For a lot of people anyway, you know, if you want to go looking for the truth, where do you even start? So it is a break. It's a very different book from the other two.
You mentioned that these are novels of apocalypse in different kinds of ways. We're recording this podcast in November 2020, when on both sides of the Irish border, where we are located, there are various kinds of lockdowns in place. A lot of your writing thinks about how societies change over time. It's one of the points that you make in your fiction that crisis is normal.
I don't know if it's a point. I try not to make points, so I probably do it anyway because I'm quite opinionated. But yes, I mean, absolutely. One of the things I'm trying to do with this trilogy is say, look, you can pick out any point in history and something is collapsing. Now, I don't want to use that to sort of play down the situation we're in now, actually, because I think it's quite unique. I don't think, you know, we haven't had to deal with climate change before. We've got all sorts of problems which actually are pretty unprecedented in human history. Nevertheless, you know, the rise and fall of nations, the rise and fall of cultures, invasions, worldviews falling apart, religions being replaced by other religions. I mean, it's the story of human history everywhere in the world. And I'm examining those kind of rise and falls in a very small part of the world, which just happens to be my part, you know, a small part of England. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are two things, I suppose, which are related. One of them is that absolutely that kind of upheaval is eternal. So there's no point in history you can go to and probably find peace in that sense, in the sense of an unchanging world. But at the same time, there's a kind of spiritual depth that people are trying to connect to. There's a sense of something higher than themselves, in which they're seeking maybe shelter from that, but also truth as well.
So we come to the third installment in the trilogy. Given everything we've said about Apocalypse, it's probably not an ending as such, but a beginning, or the possibility at least is raised. But where does this take you in your writing, Paul, from here on out? What might be your next plan?
Yeah, well, that's the question, isn't it? I feel like I'm sort of, I feel like I just got divorced after a 10-year marriage. It's a bit strange. I don't know, honestly. I mean, I think these are three very intense, quite distinctive novels. They're all written in their own language in a way, or their own version of English. I don't seem to know how to write fiction in normal English anymore, which is probably a bit of a handicap. I think I'm quite alienated from the mainstream world of literature, whatever the hell that is. Doesn't feel like it's something I'm part of. I don't know, honestly. I mean, I feel like that's the end of this novel very tightly and carefully closes itself up with the beginning again. So it's like a closed circle, this trilogy. And I don't know what I'll write next. I think it probably won't be like this. I imagine, given how predictable I am, that the themes will probably inhabit whatever I write again, because I don't seem to be able to write about anything else. I'd like to go and write a book about flower arranging or something, you know, that's a bit more relaxing, but I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think I'm fated to do that. So I don't know, honestly. I wrote a book a couple of years ago, a little nonfiction book called Savage Gods, which actually was about losing my faith in writing, which was a sort of situation I went through in the middle of writing Alexandria. Of just feeling like written words beyond a certain point. And, you know, Alexandria is a very mythic book. It's really attempting to break into a world that in some ways words can't get into. And I felt like if you spend your whole life in written words, you can feel that they start to veil the world rather than revealing it. So I wrote this little book, which was a question, a giant question. What is the point of writing? What's the value of this? What does it show us? Does it get in the way? What can it do and what can't it do? And after I'd finished Alexandria, I didn't write anything for a year. And I'm still not writing much. I've done the odd short story here and there, but I haven't got a big project on at the moment. So I don't know what will happen next. But I think things are probably reordering themselves inside me in some way. So we'll see. But I'm not rushing.
Well, we can't wait to see what you come up with next, Paul. I've been reading your work for a while, but in the last month, I've been reading virtually nothing else as I've gone back through things. And it's been an extraordinary immersive experience, actually. An extraordinary learning experience in so many ways. So thank you for your work and thank you for your time and coming to speak with us today.
No, well, thanks for yours. I really appreciate it.
And thanks to everyone else for listening in today. I'll see you next time on New Books and Literature, a channel on the New Books Network podcast.